To tell me that we are live indeed. Okay, so that,
yeah, okay, so I'm live. Good evening, everybody. We're here with Rabbi Tetz. It's a big privilege, a big honor. Usually Rabbi Tetz, when he's in Eretz Israel, he comes and joins us in the yeshiva, and he speaks there due to the circumstances he's been able to, but he agreed to come live and meet with us today on Zoom to discuss a topic which is very bewildering. There's a lot of information, misinformation, disinformation, confusion. And it's very relevant because people have to make decisions. So it's a very timely topic. Rabbi Tetz is very well placed to deal with the subject. He's written a halachic work on the subject. And he's also been in touch with leading halachic authorities, leading medical experts. He's going to be dealing with the subject this evening. We're very grateful that he came here. Just a few quick announcements. If you have a question and answer button on your screen, please feel free to send any questions. Rabbi Tetz will hopefully be able to deal with some of them, obviously not all of them. If you email me at info@oravram.com, I will give you Rabbi Tetz's email address and you can email him directly. He's kindly offered for that. And also you can visit his website, which is akivatetz.com. And there you can get more information and contact details. So questions that you have, please send them in. We may not get to all of them, but hopefully Rav Tetz can deal with some of them. And any information you want about Or Avram, also info@oravram.com if you want to hear about our sharing, our programs that we're up and running at the moment. So don't hesitate to email us and someone will be in touch with us. Without further ado, Rav Tetz needs no introduction from me. Everybody knows who he is. At least know something of who he is. We don't really know who he is because I assume he's hidden a lot of who he is, knowing him as well as I do. But it's a big, big pleasure, and it's just wonderful to have you here. And I'm going to hand over to Rabbi Tetz straight away.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Sher. It's a pleasure to have this opportunity. You're quite right. I have no idea who I am, but be that as it may, I also have not much knowledge about the subject, but that's never stopped me giving an opinion before. So, you know, why not? Let me ask, please, if any of the listeners or viewers could please just type me a greeting so I know that I'm being seen and heard. Can you do that, please? I'm not speaking to myself. Can somebody just assure me that I am live and you're out there? I see no response so far. So, Rabbi Sher, you need to assure me that that we are going out there before I start my
Rabbi Tetz, check the Q&A button. The Q&A chat is where they're all coming through.
Good. I see. I've got my chat open instead of the Q&A. Let's try that. Q&A. Okay, a couple people have answered me. Can I ask for a couple more comments, please? Or can you chat me in the chat box so that I know that I'm live again? Can people do that?
They can't chat. There's no ability for them to chat.
Okay. But they're coming through.
You have over 80, 90, 100 questions already. So
I see. Okay, good. Well, I can't see the... Oh, I see. I've got to scroll down. Okay, good, 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 good. Okay, I got it. So thank you very much. And let me, first of all, a little bit of housekeeping. I'm going to try to speak a little bit today about the COVID situation, particular reference to vaccines, conspiracies, and what I call the Lone Ranger problem. And I'm not going to talk about the background or history of COVID in particular, or so much the technicalities of the vaccines. If you'd like to know something about that, there are people who know much more than I do. And you can also listen if you want to my previous talks called Epidemics and Immunizations. Two talks, one goes through the history and some of the medical background on the technicalities of vaccinations in general and epidemics. And the second goes through the Torah approach to medicine in general and epidemics and vaccinations in particular. In this session, I'd like to talk more about evidence, how we think about these things, some of the science behind how we form opinions scientifically about things like immunizations. And as well, let's not forget to make this a Torah talk and talk about the Hashkafa or the Torah view of how we approach these things as well. Unfortunately, too many people on the session to interact live with you. So please don't hesitate, type your questions in. Again, I probably won't have time to answer them specifically. I'll do my best at the end of this session. And any unanswered questions, please feel free to email me at my akivatetz.com. You're welcome to do that. I'll do my best to respond to everyone. But what I'd like to, first of all, thank Rabbi Sher and Or Avram for this opportunity. I think everyone knows that it's a preeminent yeshiva in Israel, absolutely at the top, of course, with Or Samach. And it's a wonderful opportunity. We go back a long way, Rabbi Sher and myself, and it's a great pleasure and honor to be able to address this very interesting topic. Let's make a few remarks about the COVID situation and a particular reference to people who are extremely confused and people who have fixed and firm ideas about various, let's call them theories or conspiracies. I think it's very important to address. As Rabbi Zimmerman, one of our leading poskim in London, has said, COVID has led to the loss of three things: taste, smell, and common sense. And of course, he's quite right. Let's do a little bit of the work of reestablishing common sense in this area and try to establish some of the logical common sense principles and scientific principles that are necessary in order to approach a subject like this from an authentic point of view, both scientifically and from a Torah perspective. I'm not speaking to you if you are totally convinced that the world is, you'll fall off the edge if you get to the edge, and that no one ever landed on the moon, and that the United States government is trying to put chips in your breakfast food so that they can monitor your brain. And if you're convinced about those things, completely convinced, unfortunately, nothing that I say will make any difference. On the contrary, anything I say is guaranteed to convince you even more. People who have fixed firm views about things, no matter whether they're logical or illogical, very, very hard to shift that. And I'm not going to try to do that. It reminds me of the story of the patient who says to his doctor, psychiatrist, he says, "Doctor, you have to help me. I think I'm a dog." Doctor says, "Okay, lie down on the couch. We'll talk about it." He says, "No, I'm not allowed on the furniture." Well, if that's you got a fixed thing, a way of seeing the world, you're going to see it that way. Unfortunately, there's nothing I can do for you. I must say that people now, we've had a tremendous rash of these theories, conspiracy theories. Some of it stems from just lack of scientific knowledge. But some of it is downright, not only illogical, but it's downright self-contradictory. For example, I've had a lot of people contacting me over a long period of time, convinced that medications are wrong. They are produced by a corrupt industry. They are designed to harm you, or at least irresponsibly likely to harm you. Medications are absolutely out. The only thing that's acceptable is alternative and natural remedies. And those same people are now emailing me to tell me that they are hiding hydroxychloroquine as a valid theory as a valid treatment for COVID. It actually is curative, but people are refusing to tell you that for some nefarious reason. These are the people who would not allow me to back any drug because the drugs are immoral and harmful. And now they're convinced that hydroxychloroquine is the solution to the problem. As long as it's anti-establishment and anti-major guidelines, they're in favor of it. I can't help you if you belong to that school. I may be able to help a little bit if you sit on the fence or you are skeptical and cynical about the establishment, and I think you ought to be. So if you don't know where to draw the line, that means dealing with corrupt manufacturing operations and corrupt governments, and we have a long history of this, you are justified in being suspicious, and I side with you on that. And the question is where to draw the line. So let's try to approach some of that and sort out some of the issues. First of all, in my personal opinion, I think it's good that people question the establishment. I think that these theories, even wild theories, there's a positive aspect to them, and that is that swallowing the dogma of the drug industry or of the political industry, I think that is very dangerous. And I think people are quite right to be skeptical about that. And I think it's very healthy. People in totalitarian countries who have been misused and abused by the entire establishment are particularly sensitive. I would say a significant proportion of the questions I personally receive are from people who were raised in those sorts of environments. And they have seen the nefarious activities and the immorality and the malicious murderous conduct of governments and establishments, and they are hypersensitive. Unfortunately, they sometimes become too sensitive because they were raised in an environment like that. They now become convinced that the American government is doing the same. That's not logical. Is it logical to assert that it's possible that these things will happen again because they've happened in the past? Yes. Should we be careful about that? Yes. Does it mean it's happening now? No. We need evidence. But one can understand where they're coming from. And so my first point is that I think it's important and valuable that people question the standing authority, and I think it's important scientifically as well. Science has advanced by people questioning dogma and questioning conventional theories, and I think that's very important. But we'll talk about where the line should be drawn in those questions. The second point I'd like to make about conspiracy theories or theories or anti-establishment theories or medical theories in the COVID era is that there's almost always some truth. There's almost always some truth in a wrong theory. If it were completely bizarre with no logic at all, then it would not survive. Unfortunately, I must say some of the theories I've been told are so close to having nothing true about them that it probably breaks my rule. But in general, I would say that there's something on which to hang some logic, some potential, even though the thing may be overwhelmingly illogical. There's almost always some truth, at least one study, even though there may be 20 or 30 or 100 studies in the other direction, one study or one expert, or when it comes to even to in the rabbinic world, there may be a vast majority of rabbinic authorities who hold one way, which is clearly what we call the Da'as Torah or the Torah approach to things. There may be one or two rabbis who disagree, right? And therefore there is a place on which to hang your theory. The question again is how much truth? I would say that in some of the less outlandish theories have been suggested to me, I would say maybe there's a 10% element of truth in it, precedence and others perhaps only 1%. I've been told recently that the COVID vaccine will sterilize you, right? COVID vaccine will sterilize you. I've also been told that it's been designed to sterilize you. Some people have been telling me that it's been designed to sterilize Africa, right, to deal with world overpopulation. And that this COVID vaccine, whichever one, all of them, will sterilize you, make you infertile. Think about that for a moment. There hasn't been enough time yet to tell that that will be the case. Medical infertility, right, the definition, the technical definition of infertility is a year of trying to produce a pregnancy in the natural and normal way. And actually most definitions require 2 years of infertility for a medical diagnosis. Some doctors start investigating couples after 1 year. But here you're talking about a vaccine that has been rolled out for a few weeks. How could they possibly know that it will produce infertility? I mean, there's such a completely illogical assertion. So some will say, well, there's some technical chemical receptor that the vaccine binds to, which is in common with the receptor on the placenta. Is that an element of truth? Well, I guess it's an element of possibility. Does that deserve to be investigated and watched carefully? Indeed, why not? In fact, some outlandish medical hunches have turned out to be right in the past. One develops a certain medical intuition, and certain hunches and certain very unorthodox hunches have turned out to be right. Indeed, why not? Let's investigate it. But to make an assertion that it is the case before an investigation and before evidence is patently ridiculous. So those are some of the issues. Let's move to the next issue when it comes to outlandish or anti-establishment theories. And that's what I call the Lone Ranger problem. Let me try to explain what I mean. There is a long history of the romanticized notion of the Lone Ranger, or the iconoclastic individual who goes against the majority, is convinced that he's right, is hounded and persecuted by the establishment, and ultimately turns out to be right. That is a very prominent, particularly in American culture, but in Western culture in general, then holds a special place in the romantic mind. The reason is, of course, that it's drama, it's a heroic, the lone individual against the majority. Not only that, it's a very Jewish story. We begin with a man who stood against the world culture. Abraham was a man who stood against world culture heroically, not just one culture, not just an empire, entire culture on earth had the courage to go against it, began as a very young person, worked out his theories without divine revelation, was prepared to be persecuted, thrown into a furnace for his beliefs, and turns out to be wrong. We are the original radicals. We're the originals going against a majority. We are small in number and go against the majority. That's who we are. And therefore, that's meritorious. Not only is it dramatic, it's historic as well, and it defines us. But not everyone who goes against the majority is right. Very often the Lone Ranger, I would say more often the Lone Ranger turns out to be the outlaw than the sheriff. And therefore, just because they make movies about the Lone Ranger and the individual who goes against the authority and has turned out to be right, does not mean that everyone going against authority is right. Most people who've gone against conventional wisdom have turned out to be wrong. You need to be alert for the ones who are courageous and turn out to be right. But just because someone goes against the authority does not mean they'll turn out to be right. There seems to be a default opinion, unfortunately, probably developed by the media and the entertainment industry, that if somebody's courageous enough to rail against an establishment, the default assumption today seems to be that he's correct. That's not right. The default assumption should be that the majority is correct. When, however, a minority has evidence, and we'll talk about evidence, then of course that's a different story. So don't assume that the Lone Ranger is correct. Let me tell you a couple of stories that I think illustrate this very well. Let me tell you a story about a Lone Ranger who was right. I'd like to be balanced here and illustrate the fact that the evidence comes down on both sides. Here's a dramatic, true medical historical story. There was a man called Ignaz Semmelweis. Semmelweis, we're talking about 1840. Semmelweis, liked to read a book about him. Sheldon Newland, who's a well-known American medical historian. Sherman Newland, right? He wrote this book about, this is called The Doctor's Plague, about Ignaz Semmelweis. Fascinating story and highly, highly recommended. The story of Semmelweis is that in the 1800s, going back to 1840, he was a young doctor, a medical student first and a doctor in training. He was Hungarian, but he found himself working in Vienna at the major Krankenhaus, as it was called, in Vienna. And he found something very interesting. He noticed something very disturbing. The women in childbirth were plagued by what was known as puerperal fever or childbed fever. A woman would give birth, develop a disastrous septicemia, a generalized infection, and die within 2 or 3 or 4 days of birth. Of course, it wasn't known then that it was infection. This was before a comprehensive germ theory was current, and it wasn't known what was causing this childbed fever. But Semmelweis noticed something very interesting. He noticed that there were two branches of the main hospital in Vienna. There was a major section of the hospital that was run by doctors, medical students in training and doctors, and another branch that was run by nurses and midwives. And the death rate after childbirth in the hospital run by the doctors was 18%, almost 20%. In fact, women were so terrified of being admitted to that hospital, some of them insisted on giving birth in the street, right, so that they wouldn't have to be admitted to give birth in the hospital. And only when they'd given birth in the street that they'd agreed to be treated. They were insisting, many women in town, on being admitted to the other hospital where the nurses and the midwives were caring for the patients. And then the death rate was about 2%. Now, that's very interesting. You're talking about 2% death rate women attended to by midwives and nurses, and a nearly 20% death rate, 1 in 5, of the women attended to by the doctors. Semmelweis was very interested. He was an objective scientific observer. This has to mean something. What was the difference between the patients in the hospital run by the doctors and the one occupied? Now, people knew that this was an issue, but no one could explain it. Ignatius Semmelweis noticed that the doctors attending to the women in labor in the doctor's hospital were walking into the hospital directly from the post-mortem anatomy dissection lab. They were dissecting dead bodies without washing their hands. They were walking into the labor ward and giving birth to children. It wasn't known at the time. Again, it's hard for us to picture this. This is long before an era in which Pasteur's work, the work of hygiene and bacterial spread of infection was understood. Today, it's unthinkable. By the way, even today, a few years ago, it was shown that the most dramatic improvement in neonatal infection in hospitals and neonatal wards was controlled. The most dramatic effect on that infection rate was simply the washing of hands, even today. Simply good, thorough washing of hands between one little patient and the next was the most dramatic method of reducing, not fancy antibiotics and intravenous therapy, but simply good washing of hands between one patient and the next. Be that as it may, it was not known at the time. So Semmelweis developed the idea that possibly there was something being carried on the hands or the coats or the bodies from the anatomy dissection lab into the labor ward. The nurses, of course, weren't having to do with nothing to do with dead bodies, and their patients were surviving. Well, you can imagine when Semmelweis put forward his theory, he was hounded mercilessly. The doctor said, "You're accusing us of being the cause of our patients' deaths? You mean it's we? You mean we're dirty? There's something wrong with us? We are the reason that our patients are dying?" Unthinkable. Semmelweis continues in investigations and his observations, and one day he happened to be dissecting a dead body with a very close friend of his. very close friend by the name of Joseph. And he and Joseph were dissecting a dead body. There was a medical student working with them. The medical student's hand accidentally slipped and his knife cut the finger of Semmelweis's friend. The finger became infected and 4 days later he was dead. And his death looked suspiciously like the septicemic death that the women were going through in their childbed fever. That gave him the final piece of the puzzle. Something from a dead body had been introduced to the body of his friend and caused him to die in a way very similar to the women. And therefore, he became totally convinced that that was the cause. You have to realize this was unthinkable at the time. He was thinking so far outside the box that nobody could relate to what he was saying. Semmelweis did the following. He decided, how can I get rid of whatever it is that is on the hands of these doctors dissecting bodies before they attend to women in labor? He took a bowl of very caustic soap, some sort of a lye solution, which he found removed the smell very effectively of the dead bodies from the hands and of the people doing the dissections. And he put it outside the labor ward in the doctor's hospital. And he insisted that every medical student and doctor walking from the anatomy dissection hall into the labor ward, put their hands in that solution before they attended to labor. And when they did that, the death rate dropped to 2%. Okay, very interesting. Do you think that was accepted? They hounded him out of town. They eventually drove him insane. He was eventually, as a young man, admitted to an insane asylum where they beat him. And ironically died of infection from the wounds he got during his beatings 2 weeks after being admitted to that place. And only after his death was the truth of what he had done acknowledged. And of course it became groundbreaking work. And today it's a famous and tragic story in the history of medicine. That is a classic medical story of the Lone Ranger, turned out to be right. Unaccepted, heroic, railed against the establishment, drove himself crazy and they drove him crazy. That happens. Do we need to be alert to that? Yes. When people come up with theories like that, yes, we say to them, evidence. We like, according to the Rambam, plausibility as well. The Rambam in one or two places talks about whether you can do things that are not directly medical, but they may be scholar related, and you want to override some prohibition. Not only do you need established veracity of what you're doing, you might need also plausibility. So there are a number of criteria that we require scientifically, and I'm not going to go into those details, but we require evidence, and we'll talk about evidence. Let me tell you another story to show you the other side of the coin. There was a man called Linus Pauling. Here we're moving into the modern era. Linus Pauling was born in 1903 and he died in 1996. Linus Pauling was a genius, American chemist. When I say genius, I don't mean ordinary genius. I mean genius, genius. He won two Nobel Prizes. Only four people have ever won two Nobel Prizes, and he was one, and he's the only one who ever won two Nobel Prizes in two different areas. He was no slouch. He was genius beyond genius. He made major breakthroughs all through the last century in chemistry, and he became an extremely famous name. He's counted as one of the 20 most important scientists ever. So he was highly intelligent. What I'm trying to show you is that conspiracy theories or abnormal theories or anti-establishment theories are not only the province of the unintelligent. Very important to know this. Just because somebody has supreme intelligence and supreme qualifications does not necessarily mean that what he says is right against the establishment. We need evidence. When somebody with his qualifications has a theory, it's worth listening to. But before you accept his theory, evidence, proof. Very seldom do we have proof in science, but adequate evidence. That's the standard we want. Linus Pauling, at some stage in his career, became convinced that mega doses of vitamin C would be curative of almost everything, of viral infections. They would stop cancer, and he became an extreme proponent of high doses, mega doses of vitamin C. Unfortunately, he was not borne out by experiment. His own experiments, others, he did experiments which he claimed showed what he purported to be the effects of vitamin C. They were not replicated. Groups around the world repeated his experiments and were unable to verify what he found. He was completely discredited about his theory of megadoses of vitamin C, and he never accepted that he was wrong. Not only that, ironically, he claimed that it would prevent cancer. He himself died of cancer, taking megadoses of vitamin C. But be that as it may, here is an individual at the peak of scientific establishment, completely against the majority, went against all published evidence against him and all opinions against him, and turned out to be roundly wrong. And of course, because of his genius, his work was checked again and again and again, and it's been proved to be incorrect. What I'm saying to you is supreme intelligence is no guarantee against a mistaken theory. And those of us who are privileged to learn Torah know, Torah is one of the major themes in the area that we call Musa, is the negias, the ulterior motives, the vested interests that lead us astray. And whether it's the story of the person who built Jericho or whichever story it is in Torah, people can drive themselves to destruction on a fixed, focused idea or belief and disregard the evidence. In my own medical practice, I'll tell you a story. This was brought home to me. When I was in practice, I had a patient who believed that certain natural products, in particular, what the product is not important at the moment, was convinced that mega doses of a certain natural product were essential to preserve health. And he himself and his family, he gave his family these high doses. I was concerned about it as his doctor. I tried to discourage him. I'm talking about a supremely intelligent individual, extremely learned, probably one of the most intelligent individuals I ever met. He continued, yeah, it was balanced in my opinion, balanced in all other areas of his life, but in this particular area, he had this. I showed him there's no evidence for it, there's evidence against it. I showed him the publications, it had been investigated, they were all wrong. He was convinced that he was correct. And then his wife became pregnant. And during her pregnancy, he insisted on giving her these mega doses of this particular natural product. And I was aware that there was published literature, soft literature. I wouldn't say the signal in the literature was, I would say, limited. I wouldn't say there was clear evidence, but there was good preliminary suggestive evidence that during pregnancy, the doses he was giving his wife of that particular substance or compound was possibly associated with congenital abnormalities, that the child might be born with certain abnormalities. And I called him in immediately and I showed him and I told him what you're doing is wrong. He said, absolutely not. This is protective. And he gave his wife, through her pregnancy, those doses. The child was born with those with one of those particular deformities that I'd warned him about. When we had our discussion after the child was born, he was sitting in my surgery, and the question came up, and I pointed out, you know, as I was bound to do, that the possible consequence of what he'd done. He said to me, "Can you imagine how much worse it would have been if I'd not given her those supplements?" You see, once a person has a fixed idea in their minds and they committed to it and bound to it, almost nothing you say can overturn that idea. And therefore, this is a sobering thought. And I urge you, we are Torah individuals. We are trained to be logical. As scientists, we should be logical. As human beings, we should be logical and respect evidence. And anyone learning Torah is trained in logic. Somebody who spends his days laboring in Gemara is trained to examine the evidence. The Gemara is nothing if not meticulous about picking arguments apart and constructing and reconstructing logic. And anybody who's a Torah individual, okay, and is not attuned to rigorous examination of the facts and the arguments and the evidence is being entirely inconsistent. The second thing Torah learning should be doing is giving you the correct hashkafa about these things. And we'll try and talk about that a little bit later. What's the Jewish outlook about indecisive evidence and about expert opinion and about things that the majority do? How do we approach that? And particularly in circumstances that we find ourselves in now, where the evidence is conflicting and very, very early. Let me talk about evidence. Perhaps the most important thing I'd like to talk about is indeed evidence. When people come up with a theory, it sounds logical or it sounds illogical. One response, the correct response is, evidence. Show me the evidence. Somebody believes that hydroxychloroquine is important, or the latest is ivermectin, or various antivirals. Whatever the theory is, whether it's natural, whether it's a drug, whether it's whatever it is, talk about vaccines, we ask for evidence. Okay? No matter whether, and we should be open to outlandish ideas. Absolutely. Let's be creative. Let's think outside the box. But the answer, but evidence, not just an assertion, right? When people are emailing me to tell me that all world leaders today are part of a Masonic plot to dominate the minds of the world. Is that possible? Yes. Is it happening? Show me the evidence. You cannot make an assertion and expect me to accept it if you don't show me the evidence. Do you have a reason for saying what you're saying? Does the standard of evidence bear you out? I'll take you seriously. Let's talk about evidence. And again, nothing more important than this. When people tell you that you ought to have a COVID vaccine, you ought not to have a COVID vaccine. Pregnant women should have the vaccine. Pregnant women should not have the vaccine. Before we talk about the Hashkafa and how we relate to these from a Torah point of view, Let's talk about the science. And by the way, your rabbi should not be pontificating and ruling on medical issues. Your rabbi is not a doctor. Your rabbi should be sending you to the doctor. The doctor should be sending you to the rabbi for medical halachic questions. When there's a question of weighing up risks, we'd like to know how the Torah weighs up the risks. When there's a question of how we conduct ourselves within a scientific context, we should be asking the rabbis, but not for the technicalities. It's not the rabbi's duty to know whether the COVID vaccine is harmful to pregnant women or the disease is more harmful than the vaccine. The rabbi's not expected to be an analyst of medical information. That's what the doctor's for. And throughout history, rabbis have asked experts in the fields. A rabbi's not expected to be a metallurgist and a dentist and a doctor and an astronaut and not expected to do that. He's expected to know where to find the expertise. And based on the information that he's given, taking a majority of medical expert opinion appropriately, with the shrewd and sophisticated knowledge of who's likely to have vested interests and who's not, the rabbi makes his decision. So we're talking first and foremost about medical evidence, scientific evidence. Let's talk about that briefly. First of all, you need to know how to read the evidence. Just accepting evidence at face value and accepting that these are the facts and therefore that's evidence. You need a little sophistication in understanding how evidence works. Let me tell you a story. After all, a picture's worth 1,000 words. Story's worth more than its words. Usually, here's a story. During the war, the United States government, during the bombing campaign, after the Americans joined the war, they were very concerned about the high losses of the airmen in the bombing attacks over Europe, right? You know that the Royal Air Force lost about 50,000 people in the bombing campaign in the air war, talking about many airmen's chances of coming home or coming home after repeated sorties was maybe three, you know, maybe one in four would die, 25% death rate. I mean, you're talking about incredible bravery and incredible sacrifices. Now, the bombers were being shot. The bombers were being shot down. They were being shot down by explosive flak from ground fire. And so the Americans decided to do something about the losses of their planes. They decided to try to armor plate the planes, protect them, put metal sheeting inside the planes at the vulnerable points to protect the planes from the ground fire. Now, you cannot armor plate an entire airplane. If you do, it won't take off. One of the most vexed issues about flight is that you need the aircraft to be light enough to fly. And therefore, you can't put lead sheeting on an entire airplane. You can do that to a submarine. You can't do that to an airplane. So they decided they needed to find where on the planes, which parts of the planes were vulnerable, okay, and put the armor plating there. Don't waste your armor plating by weighing down a plane in the places where the plane's not vulnerable. Now, how do you know where the plane's vulnerable? How do you know which parts of the plane are critical that you need to defend? Answer, evidence. See, here's what they did. They took all the planes coming back from battle and they observed where the holes were. Where were the bullet holes in the planes? Let me show you a few pictures. Here's a picture of one of the American government's, I hope you can see that. That is a map of a twin engine bomber with all the places where the bullet holes were noted to be. Notice that the bullet holes are in the wingtips, the center of the fuselage, and the tail assembly. That's where they found most of the bullet holes. Notice there are no bullet holes around the cockpit or the engines. Okay, that's not where the bullet holes are concentrated. They concentrated in particular, very, very specific particular areas of the aircraft. In fact, some of the damage was incredibly extensive. Let me show you a couple of pictures to convince you. Okay, here's a picture of a plane that returned from Europe after being shot at from the ground. There's almost nothing left of the tail structure, and that plane made it home. That plane made it home amazingly, but look how badly it was shot at. Here's another picture of the fuselage of a plane blown apart completely. You see the air crew are sitting inside the plane, looking out through the side. See, it's an American aircraft. You can see the insignia. And you see that the entire side of the fuselage has been blown open. Incredibly, the plane made it home. Here's another one where half the wing is missing. Half the wing. You see the air crew standing in the hole in the wing. I'm not sure if you can see that picture clearly, but here's an air crew, about four of the airmen in the bomber, standing inside the wing where it's been shot away. Okay? So there were extensive injuries, bullet holes in the planes. Sometimes half the plane had been shot away, and the bullet holes were always concentrated in certain areas of the plane. So the American Air Force generals decided, well, that's where we have to armor plate the planes. After all, we want to put the armor where the bullet holes are going. That, what could be more obvious? But it so happened that the American government had convened a think tank in Upper Manhattan near Columbia. In fact, not far from where the Manhattan Project was being run, developing the bomb. They assembled a group of mathematical geniuses, right, to advise them. These people worked out rocket trajectories, and they worked out ballistic information using mathematics. They made a major contribution to the war. There were some of the genius Nobel Prize winners later, and they were a group of incredible geniuses. And the American government gave them free rein, just do the work we need for the war, and explore the physics and chemistry of that might be useful to us. And that's what they did. The person at one time in charge of that group was a man called Abraham Wald. He was a Hungarian Jew. He managed to escape. He was a genius mathematician and statistician. He was born to a religious family, actually, and he escaped from Hungary just 2 years before the war began. He began in Colorado, and later he was offered a position in this. He was a genius statistician, and he led the statistics group in this consortium. Well, when they were working on this problem with the bombers, they brought in the information for his validation. And he said to them, exactly the opposite. You airmen, you people in charge of the Air Force, you've decided you need to arm the bombers, to defend the bombers, to armor plate them in the places where they're getting shot. That's the exact place where they need no armor plating. Put your armor plating in all the places where there are no bullet holes at all. Here's a picture of Wald. You can see him, Abraham Wald, right? This is taken around that time. He was a wonderful individual. Actually, he had a son who's a professor of cosmology and astronomy today in New York. He had a son and a daughter. Tragically, Wald himself was killed in a plane crash. Tragically, actually, it was a DC-3. He was lecturing in India. The United States government sent him in the 1950s to lecture in India. And tragically, he and his wife were killed at a young age. But be that as it may, Wald told them, you've got it exactly wrong. You need to put, let's look at our picture again. Let's look at our picture again of the bullet holes in the planes. Right, here's the map of where the damage is. Right, he said all the places where the damage is, you don't need armament, you don't need protection. You need protection in all the places where there are no bullet holes. You know why? Because the planes that got hit in there never came home. You're only looking at the planes that made it home. The ones that made it home with that damage are the ones that were able to fly with that damage. You don't need defense in those places. The planes can fly with that sort of damage. It's the ones that never got home, right? That got hit in the places that you aren't seeing. The ones that got hit in the engines and the cockpit, they never made it home. And that's why you aren't seeing it. And therefore, those are the places you need to defend the planes, not the ones where the holes are, the places where the holes are not. You need a little intelligence, okay? When you look at evidence, you need to know how to read the evidence. Let's move to another problem with evidence when it comes to medical evidence. Now, stay with me carefully. This is confusing, can be confusing, fascinating, but can be confusing and is critically important. Medical evidence, when you look at studies, we look at the evidence. Medicine works today by what's called evidence-based medicine. We don't use anecdotal stories. One doctor in his practice saw this, so he saw that. Is that valid as a hunch? Is it worth investigating? As I said before, yes. We don't predicate medical practice on isolated claims. We need thorough evidence, and that today there's a standard, well-established standards of how we gather evidence. For example, one of the most ubiquitous and reliable gold standards today is what we call an RCT, randomized controlled trial. What we do is we need enough people, and we work out statistically how many people we need in the trial to take, for argument's sake, the COVID vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine. That's the New England Journal of Medicine only 2 weeks ago published the official report. 20,000 people were given the vaccine. 20,000 people. 20,000 people were used as controls. You need controls. You need a group that is given the intervention. You need a group that is not given the intervention. You need to prove that the two groups are equivalent, the same average ages, the same male-female distribution, the same. You must be sure, even though you've randomized your people into two groups, you need to check that the two groups in fact are valid and are subject to the same parameters before you can make a comparison. Then you give them all something that appears to be the same. They all get an injection, and the injections have to be as close as possible to the same And not only that, each person getting an injector does not know if he's one of the 20,000 getting the live vaccine or one of the 20,000 getting a placebo, just some water. Not only that, the person administering the vaccine must not know whether it's a live vaccine or not. There must be no body language that can suggest, right, that this is more helpful or not. Two identical groups given two purportedly identical treatments, and nobody knows except the researchers by randomized number codes will ever know who got the vaccine and who didn't. And then you watch your two groups. As it happens in that particular trial, a couple of hundred people in the one group got COVID and only a few, a handful in the other, the one had been given the vaccine. Those are the ones who did not get COVID. Now you need a significant difference between the two groups. And then you unblind, as it's called, you unblind the trial and you show which ones in fact got the live vaccine, which ones got a placebo, which was inactive. And you have to show not just that there's a difference between the groups, but a significant difference between the groups, right? If you get 120 who got the disease in one group and 115 who got it in the other, that's not significant. And we have measures of significance. So you need to know, and there need to be enough in thousands or tens or hundreds of thousands of people in the trial in order to know whether there's a difference between your two groups. By the way, that's what's called a randomized controlled trial. We also have observational trials or observational studies. For example, the first 1 million doses of the COVID vaccine that's been given out, there were 9 anaphylactic reactions, which means life-threatening, sudden, acute. I'm not talking about the next day or days later. I'm talking about within 30 minutes. 9 life-threatening acute reactions to the vaccine. 9 out of the first 1 million, okay? That's about 10 times as much as we get with flu, but it's still only 9 out of a 1 million. By the way, of the 9, 7 were people who were highly allergic to many things carrying EpiPens, only 2 are not, and no one died. Although all 9 needed treatment, no one died of those 9. And that's to be expected with the vaccine observational study. But a randomized control trial, we have two groups. We need to show that there's a significant difference between the two groups. But not only that, is this proof? No, it's evidence. It's evidence. If we have hundreds of thousands of people in one group and hundreds of thousands of equivalent people in the second group, and we have a highly different statistic between the two, that gives us very strong evidence that our intervention was useful. But even then, you need to eliminate confounding variables. Confounding variables, right? For example, let's say you do an observational study. Let's say, for example, you find that everyone given the COVID vaccine, more people among them get COVID than those who never got the vaccine. Say that again. You have a COVID vaccine, has no active virus, okay? And you give it to people, and you find that more people who got the vaccine got the disease than those who did not. Does that prove that the vaccine is ineffective? No. Does it prove that the vaccine causes disease? No. You know what it probably proves? That the people who got the vaccine caught COVID from the person giving them the vaccine. The healthcare worker giving the vaccine probably infected them. In order to make sense of that observation, you'd have to know that the people who got the vaccine faced a healthcare worker, that the people who didn't, or that if they didn't face a healthcare worker in the same setting with the same chances of infection, you can't make a meaningful observation. You need to know that all the variables, what we call confounding variables, are not present. So now, let's say you do control trial. There's another problem. And here's the problem. This is called publication bias. There are many, many problems with scientific evidence, and you need to be sophisticated as how to approach the evidence. I'll just give you one. Again, this is a wonderful and long subject, but just to give a taste for the subject. Let's say you have a number of studies that come out that show that a particular drug, whether it's hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin or whatever drug it is that you're testing, let's say you do a test and you find meets all the standards and the thousands of people were involved and there was statistical significance in the trial, and it was published. And let's say you find a number of trials published. Does that mean that this proves the case? No. I'll give you one reason why not. Let's say 100 people around the world did trials. By the way, there were dozens of trials run on hydroxychloroquine. But let's say there's something interesting. Many, many trials are being run now on hyperimmune globulin, right? People who've had COVID giving their blood and their white cells being used to see whether they will infect. There's mixed signals coming in from those trials. At the moment, we're still not quite clear what the effectiveness of that treatment is. Let's say 100 trials are run. And let's say 95 of them, listen carefully, this is very important. Let's say 95 of them find that the intervention is useless, but 5 of them find that it's useful, right? That there's a good effect of the intervention. Let me ask you, which ones do you think get published? The journals published the 5 studies that showed dramatic effect. The 95 studies that showed no effect or harm are not published. You don't get paid for publishing useless or unexciting information, right? It's again the Lone Ranger. It's that study that showed an effect that's dramatic, that the researchers are very excited about, that the journals are excited about, those ones get published. But what you don't know is that for every study that got published that showed an effect, there may have been 10 studies that showed no effect or showed a harmful effect, but those were not published, okay? They were thrown in the waste paper bin. The researchers went on to other stuff. That's very problematic. Now, furthermore, we use what we call a p-value. A p-value means that we assign a chance of a random finding to every study we do. We conventionally, in most scientific areas in medicine, certainly, we use a p-value of 0.05. That means 1 in 20. That means, listen well to this, that means that when you do a scientific study and you find we gave 10,000 people this intervention and 10,000 people an inactive intervention, and we found a significant difference between the two groups. At a p-value of 0.05, that means there's a 1 in 20 chance that what you found was random. Random, okay? I'll say it again. You found a significant, highly significant result. The study was perfectly run with all the statistical power that it needed, with all the confounding variables isolated and removed. There's a 1 in 20 chance, a 1 in 20 chance that was a random finding. You can never have absolute certainty. You choose a statistical level of certainty. The convention since Ronald Fisher's days, right, to the modern era, has been around 0.05. So 1 in 20 of the studies that are done will randomly give a signal of positivity, of significance, randomly. So let's say 20 studies are done, 19 show no effect. Randomly, you'll expect one study to show an effect. That's what random means. Which one will get published? The 1 in 20 that showed an effect, but it was a random finding. How do you avoid this problem? So what I'm trying to point out is even what appears to be hardcore scientific evidence needs to be examined intelligently. You need to know what you're dealing with. These problems have been addressed. Today, for example, I'll give you one way of addressing the problem, and there are others. Here's one way of addressing the problem. You can make a registry of trials before you start them. And in fact, the American establishment has set this up. And many journals require you, they will only publish your study if you registered the study with them before you began. Don't come to us with a study that shows dramatic results because there may have been many others that did not. Register your study with us before you begin. Announce to the world, we are doing a study to test a certain hypothesis. And everyone registers their studies. Now we know what studies are being done. And therefore, when one study turns out to be positive, we know there were 19 others. And we can go and look and see whether they showed the same results or not. And if we find that one study showed positive results and 19 showed negative results, we know where we stand. That's a very important caveat that has only in recent years come to the fore. So you need to know when somebody says, I did a study and it turned out to be positive. Very nice. We ask them, was it statistically significant? Did you eliminate the confounding variables? How many other studies were done that did not show the same result of yours? And how many studies were done altogether? Because there's a 1 in 20 chance that what you found was random anyway. I hope I'm making myself clear. To make matters worse, by the way, that's the best we have. That's the best we have, and it's perfectly acceptable, but you have to be a little shrewd when you assess the evidence. Let me give you one more fascinating angle on this. There's a man called Ioannidis. Ioannidis, a Greek name. He's a professor, a Greek professor who works in the United States and in Athens as well. He's the leading authority in the world today on the problems of publication bias and scientific studies, which are purportedly significant and unfortunately often turn out not to be. Right. And today, work like his has alerted the scientific establishment and the medical system. When we look at medical studies, we know this. We're a little more shrewd than we used to be. Now, we don't just swallow a study, even if it appears to be very dramatic. We want it repeated. We want replicable studies. There are many very high standards that we apply. And in Judaism, there's no reason why we should not be accepting those standards and, in fact, demanding them. Ioannidis has shown his two most famous, just to give you some flavor for this field, his two most famous papers are, number one, why most published scientific studies are wrong. I'll say that again. That's the name of his paper. Why most published scientific studies are wrong. And I think you can get some insight into what he means by some of what we've discussed already. And his second paper is why most valid published studies probably exaggerate their results. In other words, now this is a fascinating area. A medical breakthrough is announced. A group does a study. They find fantastic results. Most of those are overblown. Most of them why most valid, correct medical studies turn out to be exaggerated. Right? Why is this? We don't have time to go into this fully, but for those with a mathematical interest, I'll point you in this direction. There are many reasons for this, but I'll tell you one. One is called regression to the mean. Regression to the mean means that when it's a fascinating issue, it means that when you have a dramatically effective result, it gains fame. But because by chance you will have a dramatically effective result, I'm talking about when the results are valid. You've done 20 studies and they're valid, they show an effect. But the one that gains the fame is the one that showed the largest effect. But that was random. You did 20 studies and they showed a useful 50, 60% benefit, right? Over the null hypothesis, which was, let's say it was 50 and they showed a 60%. But the one that gains the fame is the one that showed 90% effectiveness, but it was only one of 20 studies. And therefore, when many studies turn out to be done later, there will be a regression to the mean. You'll find that the average or mean result will turn out to be 65 or 70, not the 90 that people that made the big news and the big breakthrough. For those of you interested in these things, this is known in the jargon of the profession. This is known as the curse of Sports Illustrated. What is the curse of Sports Illustrated? For those of you who used to read those sorts of things, right, right in the unadmitted past. Sports Illustrated is probably the most famous sports magazine in the world. And here's the story. When an athlete appears on the cover of Sports Illustrated, it's known as a curse, the curse of Sports Illustrated. An athlete has an outstanding, amazing season in baseball, for example. And after that, it's known if he appears on the cover as the ultimate sportsman or athlete in that field, he's cursed. From then on, it's downhill for him. Is that true? Indeed it is. Is it a curse? No. You know what happens? An outstanding player will occasionally have an outstanding season. That is the chance. That means this baseball player, for example, right? He'll play for 10 years. There'll be a year in which he'll have some years where he scores higher and some where he scores lower. Superb scores. There'll be one year where randomly he excels himself. And instead of having an 85 or 90% average in this particular field, he'll have a 96, right? He'll have an outlying superb year. And so he'll make the cover of Sports Illustrated. There's no way he'll do that next year. There's no way he can get better than that next year. From there on, it's downhill. Not because he's inferior or cursed, but because he reverts to the mean. So he goes back to being 85 or 90%. But it appears, okay. And Yanadis has made this point very dramatically. And if you're interested in this field, you should read his papers. Very sobering. Okay. These are some of the issues you need to be aware of when you look at scientific evidence. However, we need evidence subject to these caveats and limitations. This is just a brief introduction to some of the wisdom. When people insult me, they say, doctors are blinded by their corrupt drug industry, right? And the industry publishes whatever they want. Yeah, have a little respect for the sophistication of the minds, the mathematical and statistical minds that are looking at these things, right? We're not naive enough to think that at any study that's put out, even by reputable journals, necessarily proves the fact. It sets a general mode of direction, and we require ongoing studies and replication. We need to see where there's regression to a mean. We need to see if the results are borne out. Medicine is replete with things that have been breakthroughs and turned out not to be so dramatically effective down the line. Some things stand the test of time and some things don't. Okay, so that is that's a brief introduction to this field. Let's talk about the skepticism that exists in the world today of governments and medical establishments and drug companies. Unfortunately, we're going through a phase in history where there's tremendous negativity, tremendous suspicion. It's part of the modern medical establishment, particularly in the United States, to distrust the doctor, go for second opinions and third opinions. I get calls all the time from people who've spoken to experts. I'm not an expert in special medical specialties. I get people who've spoken to their top gynecologists and surgeons and endocrinologists, and then they're calling me for my, I'm very honored and very flattered, you know, and I get it doesn't stop me from giving an opinion, but you know, that's just not right. But there's something important here. Something has happened in the medical establishment in the United States and possibly in other places to generate such distrust, I'm afraid. And there's no question that the drug industry has done things that have generated distrust. I'm not saying it's all their fault, but there have been malicious and nefarious activities. There's no question about it. Let's talk about this briefly. Have there been malicious and murderous movements? Yes, indeed. Indeed, there have been. Germany, for example, not only in its general political history in the, of recent times, but also its medical establishment. Absolutely unthinkable, murderous. Has that happened? Yes. Is it possible? Obviously. Could it happen again? Yes. Does it mean it is happening? Bring evidence. Secondly, not only malicious, have there been great irresponsibility on the part of governments and medical establishments and health departments of countries and drug companies? Absolutely, totally irresponsible. Not only in totalitarian countries or in Nazi Germany or in communist Romania or Russia. United States, I'm sorry to say, if you go back to the 1920s and 1930s in democratic America, the famous, infamous Tuskegee experiments, often they were horribly racist as well. A group of men were allowed to suffer the debilitating effects of progressive syphilis, as it happens, and the United States government and health authorities told them they were being treated where they weren't, so that the medical establishment could see what this disease would do. And they died gruesome deaths. It's true, there wasn't at that time effective treatment. Penicillin was only discovered in 1947, 48, around there. But nevertheless, they were lied to and abandoned, and it was acceptable. It was racist. From a racist perspective, it was acceptable. In the United States, we're not talking about totalitarian country. We're talking about the beneficent, modern, democratic United States. Have things like that been done? Yes. And thirdly, once we've spoken about malicious stuff and irresponsible stuff, can people be wrong? Can the establishment be wrong? Can the drug industry be simply wrong about things? Absolutely, yes. Has it happened? I'm sorry to tell you, it's probably the norm. I hate to tell you this, but the practice of medicine, if you look at the history of medicine, we know that what's done today in medicine almost certainly will turn out to be wrong in 5 years or 10 years time, and probably criminal. If I practice medicine today the way my father did and did the same things he did to patients, I'd be arrested. In his day, they were normal. In my day, what's normal is not going to be normal in 10 years time. Anyone who knows anything about medicine knows that apart from setting a broken bone, maybe, or filling a tooth, maybe, right, which has stood the test of time in more or less the same ways for many years, most other medical treatments, time moves on and the treatments turn out to be less effective and superseded by other treatments. By the way, what's the Torah attitude to that? What's the correct approach to that from a Jewish point of view? How do we handle that? You see, here's the problem. Let me briefly, I don't want to keep people too late. We could go on for hours, but let me just try to explain a very important Torah idea here. The Torah says, Verapo Yerape, you shall certainly heal. The doctor has a mandate to heal, and the patient has a mandate and an obligation to seek medical healing. No question about that. The most common interpretation of Verapo Yerape, and he shall surely heal, the most common, and Rashi mentions this, you may think that if a God makes someone ill, Hashem gives an illness to a particular individual, who are we to interfere? Hashem wants the person to suffer. Don't step in. Let them suffer. Wrong, says the Torah. It's your obligation. God gave them an illness and he gave you a mandate to relieve their pain. And see, God made someone poor. He gave you the mitzvah to give them stocker. Verapa yurape. But there's another take on it. And the take is this. Listen carefully. It's very important. Very important. The Torah says you go to seek healing from a doctor. That's a Torah obligation. I'm not getting into the Ramban and people on extremely high spiritual level during an era of prophecy where you can choose spiritual treatment in place of medical or at least together with medical treatment. Today, we have an obligation to seek medical treatment of certain type. Now, you go to your doctor because the Torah tells you to. The problem is this. You visit your doctor's surgery. You walk in, the doctor examines you. You are thereby fulfilling a Torah obligation. The problem is when the doctor writes a prescription and says, take this medication, where does the Torah say you should take that medication? Where does the Torah say that? The doctor is giving you his or her opinion about what the correct surgery or correct medication is. That's where the Torah mandate ends, it would seem. To go and see your doctor and get a medical opinion is Torah obligation. But which medication? Which medication? Not only that. When the Gemara talks about particular medications, we are forbidden to use them. Say that again. The Talmud, the Gemara covers everything. Everything. From astronomy to you name it, as we know, Torah covers everything. But when the Torah covers what purports to be medical treatments and the Gemara goes into specific therapies, we have a long-standing binding halachic obligation that we are forbidden to use the medical treatments in the Talmud. This is not the time to go to why, forbidden except for one treatment for a stuck chicken bone in your throat or a fish bone. If a bone stuck in your throat, there's a mysterious and mystical thing you can do, which is valid, and you can do it today. But apart from that, you are forbidden to use the medical therapies that the Talmud specifies. Now we're in trouble. You go to the doctor. You can't expect a prescription according to the Gemara because you're not allowed to use those. So the doctor tells you, take this antibiotic, take that vitamin, take this chemotherapeutic agent, whatever it is. Where's the Torah mandate for that particular treatment? The answer is Verapa Yerape. The Torah tells you you're obliged to do what is normal in your time and place. That's called your Hishtadlus. What's a Hishtadlus? What's a valid Hishtadlus? God heals you, not the little white tablet, but you need to take the little white tablet. Which little white tablet? What's normal in your time and place? Let me say it again. And by the way, it could be something that some might call alternative. I don't happen to be knowledgeable about alternative medicines. It's not my personal particular training, but let's say it's broadly accepted and plausible and validated by correct, not anecdotally, but by a correct, validated, what we call ismachi. That means it's been correct validation of the Talmud lays down what constitutes how many times the thing has to be successful to meet statistical significance. If that is the case, then it's a valid Hishtadlus. Again, it's not the little white tablet that heals you. It's Hashem who heals you. But you need to take the little white tablet. Which little white tablet? Whatever's normal in your time and place. How many locks do you need on your door? What's normal in your time and place? If you live in a city where people have two locks on their door, you need two locks. If you do less, you are negligent. If you do more, you lack bitachon. It's not the locks on your door that are going to save you. You can have 15 locks on your door and a brick can fall out of the roof or you need a valid Hishtadlus. Less than that is negligent. More than that is a lack of bitachon. People who are now investigating the arcane details of vaccines are not necessary. You need to do what's normal in your time and place. People who go into great detail about polio vaccines and measles vaccines, it's not necessary. What's normal in your time? COVID vaccine may not yet be normal. We'll talk about that. It's very new. We'll talk about that. But what's established as normal in your time and place, you do not need all sorts of alternatives and extremes. When the doctor prescribes a certain treatment, that you should do it very responsibly. But to start grasping at every straw is a lack of bitachon. It's not the alternative or the other treatments or the second opinions. You need a consensus of expert opinion at the top level. Rav Moshe Shapiro always used to tell me, make sure you get the best. Go for somebody who's established and validated as an expert, the best you can find. But not more than that. Once you get expert opinion and you're going according to the professional guidelines and you're doing what is necessary, from then on, up to Hashem. To do less is negligent. You're negligent for your health if you don't seek good medical treatment. But to do more than that is a lack of bitachon. And that's what's important. Therefore, Yerapa, it doesn't only mean you go to a doctor. It means you accept the normal Hishtadlus of your time and place. Very, very important. Important principle. Now, and when you do what's normal according to your time and place, and you take that therapy, you take that tablet, then from then on, it's Hashem who heals you. You get in evidence that it's not normal. You see somebody has a reaction. You see consequences. You need to start amassing the evidence. And by the way, again, with sophistication, someone recently said that someone in their family had the COVID vaccine and the person died the next day. Okay, now we have to campaign against the vaccine. Why? If somebody gets a vaccine and dies the next day, that doesn't mean the vaccine was the cause of the death. Listen carefully. If 1 million people are vaccinated, right, for sure somebody's going to die the day after they got the vaccine because people are going to die any day. If you vaccinate 10 million people, thousands of them are going to die the day after the vaccine because thousands of people are going to die on any given day out of millions of people. To make the association that it's due to the vaccine, no. We need to show that more people who got the vaccine died the next day than people who didn't get the vaccine, right? Or somebody tells me the child got the vaccine and then they became autistic the next week. Every child who becomes autistic gets autistic after they got a vaccine because every child gets a vaccine. Correlation is not causation. This is the most basic rule in all scientific investigation. Correlation is not causation, and it needs to be plausible. Right, somebody tells me an anaphylactic reaction needs to be within 30 minutes of you get an injection and 15 minutes later you start swelling up and getting a thick tongue and so forth and so on. That's plausible, and it responds to the specific treatment. That's additive evidence, right? But to say that someone got the vaccine and then a week later something happened, who says the one is the cause of the other, right? Correlation is not causation. You need to show, as a friend of mine who's a physician in San Francisco says, if you got ill after the vaccine, it's more likely that you got the disease from the person who gave you the vaccine and that the vaccine caused the problem. Intelligence, objective examination of the evidence. So the Torah Hashkafa here is you do what's normal. This has been a brief introduction to some of the thinking when it comes to examination. If you'd like some references, here's a good book, a few years old, called Bad Science by Ben Goldacre. He's a British doctor. Very interesting examination in detail of the measles autism story and many others. Very, very well worth reading. You don't have to agree with everything, but using basic science in order to understand scientific and observational and controlled studies and evidence. Here's another interesting book by Jordan Ellenberg, a professor of mathematics, How Not to Be Wrong. Okay, How Not to Be Wrong. Very interesting book about how to examine evidence, what statistics means in modern life, where it's valid, where it's not valid. Very thought-provoking and very competent by a highly competent professor of mathematics. Here's some interesting stuff in that book about Torah codes, which I think he gets wrong. Right? I think he gives an incomplete story about Torah codes, but that's a story for another time. But a very useful book anyway. Let's mention briefly, if I may, Rabbi Asher, I'm going to ask your permission to speak just a few more minutes because of the importance of the subject. But let me talk about the COVID vaccine in particular very briefly. One of the most important standards we use, and I've spoken about this before, and you can access at my website, you can listen to the talks. We have a Torah concept called Dashu Bei Rabim. That means when the majority of society throng through a certain area, it becomes normal. And when it becomes normal, you should be doing it. Dashu, I'm not talking about moral things. When the majority of society does a certain immoral thing, it doesn't become our obligation. I'm talking about safety things. When society does something that's become a norm, they put food additives in their food or colorings or preservatives, or they drive cars, whatever they do that is accepted as normal in society, even though it has a certain risk, it's acceptable. You don't need to make a risk benefit calculation before you drive your car. We know that driving a car has certain risks, very small. I'm not talking about driving in Tel Aviv. I'm talking about driving a car. We know what the risks are. It's acceptable, not because it's safe enough, but because it's normal. That's called Dashu Bei Rabim. Many places the Gemara discusses this in various medical contexts. And therefore, if it's normal, it's acceptable. And says Rav Zilberstein, based on Rabbi Yashiv, and Rabbi Yashiv told me this himself. I used to ask him my medical questions. Not only is it acceptable to do things that are the norm, it becomes an obligation. I had a patient who refused to vaccinate his children. It turned out to be whooping cough vaccine. And I won't go through the details of the story, but we went to ask Rav Eliashiv and the family accepted his ruling. Absolutely, you give the vaccine. We said to Rav Eliashiv, but the whooping cough vaccine has a risk, right? Why should the person take the risk? Rav Eliashiv said, not because it's safe enough. And not because it's a moral obligation on all the children to be vaccinated to protect everyone else, particularly the kids with cancer and those who can't get the vaccine. It's because it's normal. Rabbi Yashiv looked me in the eye and he said to me, you know, as a doctor, that throughout the whole world today, little children are given the standard vaccines. I'm not going into the particular vaccine schedule today. I personally am not in favor of every single vaccine that's given to children today. I'm not in favor of every particular one. I'm not sure whether you need HPV and various other things. However, and by the way, in South Africa, I think you need a BCG. In other countries, they're not giving it. But be that as it may, without arguing the details, what's normal is an obligation. Not just you may, but it's an obligation. Rav Asher Weiss said recently, he cannot paskin that it's a halachic obligation to get the vaccine. He feels very strongly that you ought to do it. It's the responsible thing to do. You're being highly responsible if you don't. Can he rule that it's a halachic chiyuv, an absolute Torah obligation to get it? That far I didn't want to go. Can you rule halachically that you exclude children from a school if they're not vaccinated? That's a debate among halachic authorities. But we have a concept called Dashu Bei Rabim. You're not expected to be a virologist and an epidemiologist and a drug expert. You need to know what is common sense, what the evidence suggests, what is Dashu Bei Rabim. COVID vaccine, we don't have that yet. We don't have it yet. It's not old enough to be Dashu Bei Rabim. Millions have had it. But in my personal opinion, it's not yet established like a whooping cough vaccine and a polio vaccine and smallpox when it was being given. It's not yet at that level of majority thronging through a certain area, in which case, Shem Epsoim Hashem, God protects those who do things that are normal. Not yet. Where does that leave us? Joseph Zilberstein said recently, a week ago, although it's not yet widespread to be considered a normal, that means totally accepted in society for long periods of time, but it's backed by very good evidence. Consensus of expert opinion is that the vaccines are safe and ought to be given. That's probably good enough. Look at Rav Zilberstein's tshuva on this. That's probably good enough. In other words, true, it's not yet been validated in the way that's become an accepted norm over a long period of time, but it's probably good enough that it's considered to be a normal thing that is being done at present. How does that leave us? I personally feel, I give you my personal opinion, I think the vulnerable should be vaccinated at the moment. The evidence is excellent for its safety, for its effectiveness, early evidence. I think the vulnerable, in the face of the fact that the epidemic is spiking at the moment, that we have people dying all around us. I myself have a brother-in-law on a machine at the moment, Yisrael Ben Sipora. This learning should be in his merit, and a refuah shleima for him, and everything that we do should be in his merit, and everyone else who's desperately ill at the moment. There are vulnerable people around. I think that the risk-benefit calculation is strongly in favor of their being immunized. I don't think children should be given the vaccine at the moment. I don't think so. Teenagers, I don't think so. I think we can afford to wait since they're not vulnerable and their chance of dying is relatively small, very small. That's my personal opinion. If we get to a situation where it's much more accepted for a long period of time, don't ask me how much time, that's a personal judgment issue, or we need it for herd immunity to protect everyone else, that might be a different story. At the moment, that's what I feel. One of the vexed issues at the moment, should pregnant ladies get the COVID vaccine? We're not sure. We are not sure yet. We're not sure. The signals in the literature are not yet strong enough. We don't have large enough numbers to be confident about this. We certainly know that pregnant ladies are vulnerable. I wouldn't say extremely vulnerable. We're not yet clear about the statistics and the figures. We know that certainly they're not immune, even though ladies are at less danger than men. I think that probably the correct course of action for the immediate present is to follow the local guidelines. Follow local expert guidelines. Ask your obstetrician. I don't know enough to have an opinion about that. I'm looking at the literature. I don't think the signal is strong enough to be clear about it yet. It's a question of medical judgment. And I think you are fully entitled and probably should go with expert opinion in your time and place. I don't see why not. But over the next weeks, hopefully, we'll get better figures about pregnant women getting the vaccine, both effects on the fetus, protection for the mother. Mother's life comes first in halacha, by the way. I think that's what we need to look for. So this has been a brief introduction to our subject. I'd like to mention just one more thing briefly. Again, this is an endless discussion. Please take this effect seriously. We are not claiming that a vaccine is entirely safe. Not at all. The Ramban says there's no, Ramban, who was a doctor, Ramban, Nachmanides, there's no medical treatment that is safe. The Ramban says what heals some kills others. There's no such thing as a safe medicine. Not the simplest local anesthetic, not the simplest aspirin tablet, nothing completely safe. And no vaccine is completely safe. No vaccine completely safe. However, we make a benefit, a risk-benefit calculation. When the benefit outweighs the risks, society decides that we vaccinate, right? Again, we don't claim polio vaccine. Let's take polio. The live vaccine, there are two different types of polio vaccines. The live vaccine causes very rare, occasional, but definite reversion to a wild type polio. And some people who get the polio vaccine get the disease, and some of those get paralyzed. Today, every year in America, 8 to 10 people, children who get the polio vaccine, it's usually the mother. The baby gets the vaccine, there's a reversion to an active form of the virus, and it's usually the mother attending to the child who gets the polio. But today, a handful of people out of the tens of millions who are vaccinated every year in the United States get the disease from the vaccine. In fact, many of the anti-vaccine people will tell you that it's criminal that the vaccine is given for polio. Why? Because nobody gets polio today. The only cases reported of polio today in the United States are due to the vaccine. So they say to you, look, it's obvious. No one's getting polio, right? So we're not threatened by polio. The only people who are getting sick are people who have the vaccine. What they fail to realize is nobody's getting polio because everybody's getting the vaccine. Nobody's getting polio because the tens of millions of people who are immunized are no longer getting polio. The only ones who get it are the tiny percentage of people who get a complication. Okay, by the way, because the disease has been so well controlled, the World Health Authority World Health Organization is now in favor of the inactivated vaccine rather than the live one. and this is an ongoing debate, but that may have to change, unfortunately, because of anti-vaccination. People who are now allowing polio to come through again, if they're having paralyzed people again, unfortunately and tragically. We do not claim that a polio vaccine or any vaccine is entirely safe. We don't claim it's like that. But we claim that the risks, the damage to the number of people who will be harmed by the vaccine is much smaller than the people who will be harmed by the disease. And therefore we do it, knowing that we're causing damage to some people. Absolutely. I asked of Zilberstein a few months ago about a disease that is rampant in Malaysia and Brazil, a viral disease, okay, which affects children, unfortunately, tragically. And there they've discovered a vaccine. The problem is that the vaccine kills a few of every million people who get the vaccine, a few die from the vaccine. But 1 in 10,000 kids die from the disease. Much more. In other words, here's the problem. If you don't give your child the vaccine, there's a 1 in 10,000 chance of your child dying from the disease. If you do, you prevent that, but there's a 1 in 1,000,000 chance that the child will die from the vaccine, right? Charles Zilberstein said, absolutely, it's an authority to vaccinate the population. Why? The fear that the child you are giving the vaccine to will die from the vaccine is a real fear, right? And unfortunately, the tragic psychological effect will be that you did it, that we gave a vaccine and the child died. It's terrible to think about. It almost paralyzes us. But the unfortunate fact is, if you don't give the kids the vaccines, much more of them will die from the disease. And Rav Zilberstein Paskin on that particular Shiloh, that we should be giving the vaccine to those children in Malaysia, right? Even though we are imposing a harm on them with our own hands for the vaccine, because the harm we're imposing is much less likely than the risks of the disease itself. And society is entitled to accept such things. And once society accepts that, and therefore, even if you can show me that somebody who had the vaccine died the next day as a result of the vaccine, that doesn't mean we should not be giving the vaccine. It means we need to be cautious and do studies to see how common that is and can it be prevented. So I hope this is made clear. I hope this has made clear some of the important variables here. Above all, avoid idolizing and idealizing the Lone Ranger. Give him his credit, give him his due, but make sure he's the Lone Ranger who's the sheriff and not the Lone Ranger who's the outlaw. I'm going to stop here, although obviously there's much more to say. I'm sorry I can't answer questions. I do see hundreds of questions here, and I apologize. There's just no way I can go through the questions in this context. Please email me through the website. I'm seeing a lot of comments here, and I'm seeing people quoting me, individuals and people who've done their own private studies and anecdotal work. People asking me about masks and all sorts of I'm sure very, very valuable stuff. There's just no way I can do justice to your particular questions. Okay, I'm getting a few extreme hate messages here about somebody's telling me that when I'm in favor of vaccines, I'm telling people to inject themselves with tumor filth, nanotechnological weapons, etc. Well, my comment to a person like that is, give me the evidence, please. Give me the evidence. When you claim that people are injected with nanotechnology, little microchips in the vaccine, is that possible? Yes. Is it happening? Give me the evidence. So this person who's sending me this message and telling me that I'm telling people to inject themselves with nanotechnological weapons, give me the evidence, please. Don't make an assertion. Give me the evidence. If you show me the evidence and you see it under the microscope, let me know. Okay, we stand or fall by the evidence. And I thought that point was made very clearly. Anyway, I hope most of these other questions are not such a tone. But thank you very much, Rabbi Sher and Orav Ron, for this opportunity. I apologize for not being able to make it live and interactional. There are just too many people on the session. I apologize for not being able to answer the questions. First of all, I'm not the last word on this, by no means. Just some thoughts about thinking objectively, demanding evidence, and going by the standard, which is of an intervention that becomes a standard, a little bit more cautious before it becomes a standard. You know, the Tzanzer Rebbe, the father of the Tzanzer Rebbe, actually, when the smallpox came to Israel, smallpox vaccination, he was very much in favor of it. But he told his family and the girls who were asking him, the daughters and granddaughters, he said, very important to get the vaccine. try not to be among the first 100 to get the vaccine. Very interesting. You don't have to rise to be the first 100. It's a very good thing. Everybody should be vaccinated, along with many other people who are very in favor of vaccines. Right? Saved millions of lives. You don't have to be among the first to get an experiment, a new modality. That's the sort of tone I think is sensible, and it's a question of balance. I hope I've illuminated some of the issues here, particularly with respect to evidence and examination of evidence. And I'll leave you with this thought that when the Lone Ranger rides in and claims to be the sheriff, we ask him evidence. Thank you very much and all the best.
Just want to thank Reverend Tetz very much. Obviously a very complicated, difficult subject, just the surface. Reverend Tetz has a book. You're welcome to look at it as well. A lot of these principles are brought down there. Dangerous Therapies and Dangerous Diseases, it's called. And you can also, those who never got answers to their questions, we're sorry, there's just too many people out there. We overwhelmed here by how many people there were. We thought 500 would be enough. Obviously wasn't. There a lot of people who could get in. The recording will be made available for those. If you know people that couldn't get in, we got a lot of emails and WhatsApps about people who couldn't get in. I apologize. We couldn't have predicted it. There will be a recording made available tomorrow. And anybody who wants to be in touch with Reverend Tetz directly, please go to his website, kivatetz.com. Am I right? Kivatetz.com, and you can communicate with Reverend Tetz directly there. So thank you everybody for participating. Hopefully it's given food for thought. And for more clarity, please be in touch with Reverend Tetz or your own personal rabbinical authorities and doctors. All the best. Thank you very, very much. All the best.
My pleasure. Thanks, everyone.